This is KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our seven-county listening area in central Iowa. I am your host for today, Susan Franzen, and we're starting out our program with an interview with Sarah Starman, who is new in Iowa. She came with an organization called Mighty Earth and has been connecting with people and introducing her concerns with a forum, which was in Davenport, I believe, last week, and on Monday was in Des Moines. The title is Corn, Climate, and Conservation. And she's here to talk to us about it and to talk about what she's finding in Iowa. Sarah, are you there? Oh, well, good. First, how did the forum go on Monday?
It was wonderful. So we hosted it at the Central Public Library in Des Moines, and about 35 people came out to talk about the future of agriculture and our environment in Iowa. And so we had a panel of speakers talk about these issues, and it was a really great discussion.
Well, who were the speakers?
So the three speakers were Dr. Thomas Rosberg, who's a professor at Drake University and who is a sustainable farmer himself. And then Emma Schmidt, who's an organizer with Food and Water Watch, which is just a nonprofit that works to fight for clean water and healthy food. And then Margaret Hansborough, who's a campaign director and energy specialist at Mighty Earth.
Were there any representatives from organizations from Iowa?
Yes. Well, Food and Water Watch does have a longstanding chapter in Iowa, and then Mighty Earth has a local chapter here, and then also the Xerces Society was there to hand out some information.
For those who don't remember the stories that we've done on the Xerces Society, what is that?
Oh, it's an organization that works to protect pollinators, particularly bees, which are, you know, the backbone of our food system and our ecosystems here.
I thought it was also interested in butterflies, as I recalled.
Yes.
That was their logo, was a butterfly.
Yeah, they've done a lot of work to protect the monarch butterflies as well.
And what is the underlying purpose and goal of Mighty Earth?
Our goal we're a national organization, and our overarching goal is to fight climate change and protect wild spaces, particularly forests, wetlands, and grasslands. In Iowa, our goal is to reform federal biofuel policy that's had a lot of negative impacts on Iowa's local environment.
What parts of the biofuel policy are you trying to reform?
So in particular, we're concerned about the mandate for corn and soy-based biofuels that's included in the renewable fuel standard, because we feel that since the renewable fuel standard created the mandate for corn and soy-based biofuels, we've seen a lot of wild land converted to cropland, and losing these wild spaces has destroyed wildlife habitat and increased water pollution, as well as contributed to climate change emissions.
You've seen wild lands converted to corn and soybeans in Iowa?
Yeah, so in Iowa, a recent study from the National Wildlife Federation showed that we have lost about 400,000 acres just in Iowa, and then about 7 million acres across the entire U.S.
Now, this is exactly to go from corn and soybeans from wild lands to corn and soybeans, not to urban sprawl, because we lose a lot to urban sprawl.
Yes, exactly. Those numbers are just to corn and soy. Although, yes, there has been a big issue with urban sprawl as well.
So what were some of the things that your panelists were talking about on Monday night?
Basically, what we wanted them to speak about was what are some of the challenges with our current agricultural system here in the Midwest, particularly in Iowa. You know, what are some of the biggest problems they see with the way we do things right now? And they spoke about water pollution. They spoke about monoculture. They spoke about, you know, climate change and energy use. And then after that, we asked all of the speakers to talk about what they thought the solutions were and what they thought the future of agriculture looked like. And given that we're facing a lot of environmental issues and climate change, how is our system going to adapt in the next 10 years to deal with these problems and to really become more sustainable? And then we also asked them, you know, what are some of the barriers to change? And if we know some of the better, more sustainable agricultural practices, what is standing in our way? And so it was really interesting to hear the three different speakers who have very different perspectives kind of dive into those questions.
Well, I'd be curious to know what they saw as standing in the way, because, of course, this is a pretty entrenched system now. What did they see as barriers, and how could we confront them?
Yeah, I think it's very interesting because all of the speakers had different perspectives, but one thing that did come up with was just our political system and the fact that many of the speakers felt that our current politicians and some of our legislators were introducing policies that didn't make it easy for small farmers and family farmers to be sustainable. And maybe there were some policies that benefited big agribusinesses more than rewarding small family farms who were trying to be more sustainable and, you know, actually protect our environment. And that we just needed better incentives at the federal level, at the state level, and at the local level for sustainable practices.
And I'm particularly interested in Rosberg, because I have been watching him. He's a lawyer who's been working on city codes, and I looked him up on his website, and it was sort of overwhelming what's involved in city codes. But Ames is currently looking at having a sustainable plan, and What specifically did he see? Did he see this mostly through just regulations everywhere, or what was it?
He actually did not talk about his work on city codes. He mostly spoke about, so for 5 years, he ran full-time a small family farm, and then he still produces a little bit of his own food, even though he's transitioned more to being a professor now. And he talked about what he tried to do on his farm in order to improve soil quality and reduce water pollution. And he feels that it was easy. So that was in the 80s when he did this. And he feels that since then, it's become much harder for people to run small farms sustainably the way he did then. And yeah, he thinks that there just needs to be more incentives and rewards for people who do things like using cover crops, and, using less tillage and planting buffer zones to prevent water pollution and practices like that.
Did anyone talk about the changes that might occur because of the shock that our corn system has gotten from, say, international tariffs or the shock it's likely to get from flooding?
Yes, we did talk about the flooding, and especially the impact that that's going to have on our soil. And it was actually Professor Rosberg again who mentioned that it sometimes takes 75 to 100 years to develop an inch or two of topsoil, really good, fertile topsoil. And when we have these floods, it can take away, you know, 3 to 4 to 5 inches at a time. So we can lose hundreds of years of soil development in just one flood. And that's devastating to our farm system. And as we continue to see more increased rainfall and more flooding, I do think, there's going to be a lot of impacts on corn and soy and all kinds of agriculture in our state, and that it's going to start causing some real problems. And I hope that pretty quickly we can build a more resilient system that's more prepared for those impacts.
You have just brought up several issues that we either have dealt with or will be dealing with in the next few programs, particularly a concern with the watersheds, because actually there's a bill that I'm about to follow in the legislature that would de-incentivize buying land to protect it within the National Heritage Foundation. And of course, this is a way to preserve particularly marginal lands, wetlands that should be preserved. But the argument was that young farmers need these lands, and they're being taken out of production by being set aside. So we need to be aware of what our current legislatures are doing, not just what our past ones have done that are destructive. Is there anything else that you would like to talk about before we leave?
Just kind of summarize how I see these issues and what I was thinking about during the panel. I think our agricultural system needs to change in a lot of ways. You know, if we're really going to keep our food system going for the next 10 or 20 years, it needs to become more sustainable and be in more harmony with our environment. And you know, that means investing more in clean energy and investing more in crop diversification and, yeah, just really taking care of our wild lands as well as our farmlands, because without our wild lands, we lose a lot of our pollinators and wildlife and water protection. So I am excited to see how it will change, and I just hope that we can really come together and do it quickly so that we're prepared for the future.
Thank you very much, Sarah. And in case you just tuned in, this has been Sarah Starman from Mighty Earth talking about the forum Corn, Climate, and Conservation, which was held in Des Moines last Monday.
Thank you, Susan. Thanks for having me.
And speaking of forums, however, there is an event taking place up in Storm Lake that I learned about it because I went to the Author Cafe at the Ames Public Library, where Art Cullen and Michael Crum talked partly about newspapers, but also a lot about agriculture, because that's, of course, what Art Cullen won his Pulitzer Prize in 2017 for. This little paper, one of two local papers in Storm Lake. His paper had a series of editorials about agriculture, and he did some pretty strong investigative journalism to uncover some practices that had not been made public, attracted the attention of the Pulitzer Committee. So he's just written a book with the title Storm Lake. But the forum is really quite interesting because it is, surprise, surprise, a gathering of Democratic primary candidates. It's up at Buena Vista University in Storm Lake on March 30th, Saturday at 1 p.m., when the Iowa Farmers Union is hosting the Heartland Forum to bring together these Democratic presidential contenders to discuss their ideas for solving the range of economic and social challenges facing rural and small-town communities in Iowa and beyond. For more information, including how to reserve tickets, because it's going to be in the auditorium at Buena Vista University, so there's limited seating. So to reserve tickets, see the link in our website or go to the Iowa Farmers Union Facebook page. Either one will give a list of the candidates who are coming, and I think the list has been growing. So I do know that it includes John Delaney, Elizabeth Warren, and Juan Castro. Could we have the Iowa Corn Song? I think that's appropriate for what's coming next. This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. We've said goodbye to Sarah Starman, director of Mighty Earth, and we are now going to talk to Monty Shaw, executive director of the Iowa Renewable Fuels Association. With the recent threats to the renewable fuel standard coming out of Washington, Monty's interview will likely be of interest to people with all opinions about ethanol and biodiesel. Let's start with what he has to say about ethanol plants.
Well, we're a state-level independent trade association. It's a voluntary group, so if you produce ethanol or biodiesel or some other renewable fuel in the state of Iowa, you could choose to join and sit on our board and tell us what to do. And in short, that mission statement is to take on whatever activities we can to promote the production and use of renewable fuels. So we'll do things, market development, consumer education, regulatory work, lobbying work sometimes, and things of that nature.
Do you have all of the ethanol plants in your association?
No, not every ethanol plant in Iowa is a member.
So how many ethanol plants total are there?
We do it by members, so we have 18 members right now. That would include 15 ethanol members and 3 biodiesel members. Some of those members have multiple plants. You know, we're up in the mid to upper 20s in terms of the plants we represent, and there's 43 ethanol plants in the state of Iowa currently.
So the Stover plant over in Nevada is also with you.
It was sold off to a renewable natural gas producer, so we no longer list it as an ethanol plant in the state of Iowa.
Well, to get back to the ethanol plants, I was particularly interested in the locations of those plants, because my impression was those are mostly in small towns, and in many cases they're a major industry for the town.
That's true. And on our website, which is iowarfa.org, under ethanol.
So what is the total production of those plants?
So in Iowa, we produced a little over 4.3 billion gallons last year. They could produce more. But, you know, it's dependent upon the market. So we did produce a record amount in 2018 of ethanol, and that was 4.35 billion gallons. We also produced a record amount of biodiesel at 365 million gallons.
Well, I know that with ethanol, it's at every pump. So there's no problem unless you have the E15. Do you lobby for that or you work on that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, right now, I mean, because E10 is, you know, as you mentioned, more or less ubiquitous and is by far and away the largest user, you know, 90% in Iowa, something like 95% nationwide of fuel is going to be E10. There's not a lot of growth opportunities there for our industry. So we do spend quite a bit of time promoting near-term options like E15 that can be used in all 2001 and newer cars, which is basically almost all of them now. And it's over 95% of the fuel goes in those cars now. And we also are doing things on the regulatory side and whatnot to try to, you know, be working toward even higher blends in the future.
Yes, I heard about E85.
Yeah, so E85 is available now. It's about one in every 10 Iowa gas stations offers E85. Unfortunately, due to some changes in the incentives for the automakers under the Obama administration, we're seeing a fairly dramatic drop in the production of the flexible fuel vehicles, FFVs for short, that are required to use E85. It's kind of a sad story because, you know, we've really had an expansion of E85 availability over the last 2 or 3 years. And it's corresponded with a reduction in production of the cars that can use it. So we are working hard to try to convince the current administration to reverse that and to put in a small incentive, say in the CAFE standards or something like it used to be, for automakers to continue to produce flexible fuel vehicles.
Well, of course, environmental fuels implies that this has significant environmental benefits. What are those?
Yeah, so there's a number of positive benefits from the use of ethanol. And so you mentioned, you know, there's price, there's energy security, there's the impact on rural economies and jobs, and you mentioned the environment. I kind of break it into two different boxes on the environment side, but however you want to look at it, doesn't really matter. So one is the reduction in tailpipe emissions. So as you add ethanol, you're doing one of two things, and it kind of depends on how it's blended. You're either directly replacing petroleum-based octane components with ethanol to get the octane you need to, you know, for the car to run. And if you're doing that, you're quite dramatically reducing the use of some wonderful chemicals, I say that tongue-in-cheek, called benzene, toluene, and xylene. Benzene is a known human carcinogen, and the combustion of those chemicals in our engines leads to the exhaust of ultrafine particulate emissions, which are really, really bad. And in fact, I would say only in the last 4 or 5 years has serious study been done on these things, and at least preliminarily, the impact looks horrific on people who are exposed to exhaust fumes. So particularly urban folks and say, let's say Harvard's done some studies where it looked at some of the poorer neighborhoods that are clustered around the, you know, like very close to the interstates, you know, or big roads. The children living there are particularly harmed. And so that's something that we reduce. So whether it's carbon monoxide, whether it's particulate matter, and other things like that. Now, even when you go from E10 to E15, and you're more or less just adding another 5% ethanol on top, you might say, you're still diluting, right? So you got the actual displacement of some of those products with ethanol as you went to E10, and then as you go up the food chain, you just continue that displacement or dilution, however you want to look at it. So it absolutely has a beneficial impact on, you know, what you're breathing because of how it cleans up the tailpipe emissions. Now, the other big environmental issue that's in the news these days is obviously climate change and carbon emissions and things like that. And the biofuels are significantly reduce the carbon footprint of the fuels in your car. And so for folks that are looking to do things to kind of decarbonize the transportation sector, ethanol and biodiesel are by far and away the most impactful things you can do in the near term. And so we think there's a big role to play there as more and more states domestically and more countries internationally are putting a carbon metric in their fuel requirement.
Is all of your ethanol, is that by definition corn ethanol?
No, it's not. But to be straightforward, the vast majority of it is. The ethanol molecule is the same once it's produced, regardless of the biomass feedstock. So any biomass we could turn into ethanol. The world's cheapest source of ethanol is from corn starch. We also have a number of plants, and we wish the number was higher, but the EPA has not, for the last year, has been stuck in neutral in approving new approvals for these plants to do this. But we have the capability now, through different enzyme technologies and different things, to produce ethanol not just from the corn starch in the kernel, but from the fiber that's in the kernel as well. And if we can convert that fiber, or at least a portion of that fiber, a significant portion of that fiber in the corn kernel, we can produce more ethanol for the same bushel of corn, and the resulting distiller's feed that comes out of that, our feed co-product, with the fire, you know, the starch is gone. That's good because cows, chickens don't need any more starch in their diet than I do. You know what I mean? That's not what we're short of. We're short of protein. Well, if we can take some of the fiber out of there as well, that really makes the distiller's grains a very high protein feed as well. You know, kind of rivaling soybean meal. It's a good feed no matter what. It's just another way of, you know, kind of adding value to the feed because it's a more concentrated protein on one hand, plus you're getting more ethanol by converting the fiber as well. So that's primarily what we're seeing in Iowa. There is Project Liberty up near Emmitsburg, which is producing some cellulosic ethanol from corn stover, you know, the corn residues.
Yes.
that was also what DuPont had planned in Nevada, but when they went through their restructuring, that project kind of got shuffled out of the deck, and so that's been sold off. But in other parts of the world, you have ethanol that's made from sugarcane, cassava, even here in the United States, not in Iowa, but in Kansas and other places where it's a little drier, they'll make it out of grain sorghum. So there is a diversity.
Yes, and now I have discovered the quote from Art Cullen that I thought would be a counterbalance to this discussion. It's his historic view of what happened with ethanol, and I think I'll start with the post-World War II ag boom had ended. Smelling a bargain as farm assets imploded, Wall Street started to invest in pork in the late 1980s, the same way it had invested in concentrated integrated poultry production. It discovered that you could make pretty decent money using cheap corn and cheap help in a building built by the farmer with his own debt to raise hogs on contract for the meat packer. At the same time, the farms that had been selling were moving into stronger hands. It was a triple whammy. The cattle left Iowa because the land was too valuable. Hogs moved indoors and out of open markets, and the stronger landowner could use chemicals to manage ever larger acreage inventories. Ethanol, made from distilling corn, was reaching commercial scale after a strong decade of experimentation spawned by the oil crisis of the 1970s. Farmers long besieged by corn price swings saw energy demand as a way to stabilize corn markets and sow a new base outside traditional livestock feeding. Ethanol and the corn sweetener industry developed simultaneously based on the zeal of Midwestern corn farmers who came to see it as their salvation from just making do feeding corn to hogs, cows, and chickens. Ethanol came to be politically sacrosanct as it grew to consume a third of Iowa's corn crop. In 2017, more than 4 billion gallons were hooched from 43 distilleries in the state. It was a bipartisan purchase of the rural vote by Democrats and Republicans. The golden cap came with the energy legislation in 2007 that established the renewable fuel standard, requiring 15 billion gallons of ethanol to be blended with gasoline nationally to reduce smog in big cities. These developments bankrupted farmers. Wall Street investing in livestock for the first time and moving them off the landscape and betting on the corn ethanol game ushered in the specialization of agriculture in the late 1980s and squeezed out on-farm diversity and unneeded people. It suited the big ag players. The seed and chemical companies could deal with fewer customers who were bigger and could be locked into their supply chain. The corporate players didn't need the retail feed stores or the local general veterinarian in the county seat towns anymore. The pork integrators had their own feed mills and vets on retainer. The result was a steady drain on rural life. The impression was indelible in physical and psychic terms. Had the sun set on the place we cherished. And I guess that's what the Mighty Earth people are talking about. But ethanol is only part of the issue here. And Monty also spoke to us about his version of the corn that goes into ethanol. I have a question about the scale of the industry. One, but how many acres do you think it takes to produce the amount of ethanol that you have, the corn ethanol you have? And the other one would be what proportion of the corn crop is used for ethanol?
Yeah, nationwide it's about a third, but I want to stress something here, and it's because that's to make ethanol, the industrial corn oil that we sell, and all of the high-protein distillers' feed products that we sell. It's not just ethanol. The only thing those ethanol plants are converting into ethanol is the corn starch out of that kernel of corn. And for a handful, we hope more in the future, but for a handful, they are able to convert some of that fiber if they got their approval before EPA stopped giving approvals under EPA Administrator Pruitt, who's gone now, and we're hoping that those will start up again. 100% of the protein goes back out into the animal feed market where the corn would otherwise go. So I just want to stress that. In Iowa, because we have a higher concentration of ethanol plants, we'll use, you know, and of course it depends on the demand of ethanol in any given year that rises and falls, and depends on how much corn we produce, which, you know, Mother Nature makes sure, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 to 55% of Iowa corn will go into an ethanol plant. Again, not just to make ethanol, but to make ethanol and the feed co-products. About 1.5 billion bushels of corn are going to be processed in Iowa into ethanol and those feed products.
And there's another biofuel we haven't talked about yet that is not connected to the renewable fuel standard. It's biodiesel. And it's a lot more beneficial as a fuel than ethanol is. I'd like to read from the IRFA, that's the Iowa Renewable Fuels Association website. Biofuel is a greenhouse gas reducing advanced biofuel that is a great alternative for diesel users. Biodiesel is not only sustainable, it's more environmentally friendly, cleaner burning option that can be used in diesel engines without modification. In fact, biodiesel decreases greenhouse gas emissions by 56% to 86%, meaning that the use of biodiesel has already cut 75.5 million metric tons of carbon pollution. That's like planting 1.9 billion trees. Biodiesel is also non-toxic and biodegradable. Using biodiesel lowers particulate matter by 47%, reduces hydrocarbon emissions by up to 67%, and reduces smog. Its environmental benefits don't stop there. The production of biodiesel in lieu of petroleum diesel reduces wastewater by 79% and hazardous waste by 96%. Biodiesel does all this while also providing the highest energy balance of any U.S. fuel, a 5.5 to 1 positive energy balance. This means that for every unit of energy input, biodiesel returns an astounding 5.5 units of energy. So let's hear what Monty Shaw has to say about biodiesel. Do you have many biodiesel plants?
Yeah, I mean it's you know, it's similar but different. I mean biodiesel is its own it's a very different process, comes from different feedstocks, and if you know, at the simplest terms, ethanol is typically blended with gasoline, and biodiesel, as one might suspect, is typically blended with diesel. So we do have a number of plants in Iowa. We have 11 operating plants that can produce, well, they produced over 365 million gallons last year, which was a nice step up. They could probably produce, not quite, but closer to 400 million gallons if the market demanded it. They use a diversity of feedstocks. Here in Iowa, we primarily use soybean oil. We have a lot of soybean production, a lot of soybean crush facilities here in Iowa, so we'll use the soybean oil. We also use a lot of corn oil. The ethanol plants can actually separate the corn oil from the distiller's feed product at the back end of the plant, if you will, and sell it separately to feed markets and to biodiesel producers. And so corn oil has become a growing market. We also have different types of animal fats and greases, as well as we haven't done any canola oil here recently, but there's parts of the country and the world where they use a lot of canola oil. In other parts of the country, sometimes it's called rapeseed oil. And then one of the growing markets, particularly in larger metropolitan areas, is the used cooking grease or the used cooking oil. And so that's an exciting development where you used to have laws being enforced that tried to prevent restaurants from dumping the stuff down the sewer drain because that's not a good environmental practice. Now those same cities have passed laws making it a crime to steal it because now it's valuable because people will pay for it to convert it into biodiesel. So,
are all of these plants owned commercially, or can people just find a way to burn the local grease that comes out of their...
Well, there are people who do that. I'm not going to tell people not to do it. I'm just going to tell you that to ensure that your car runs properly and for a long period of time, you have to have on-spec fuel, fuel that meets all the required specifications. And those are very tight specs, very high quality. You know, when you're in one of, you know, my members that's producing it at an industrial level, a commercial scale, they are meeting extremely, extremely high quality specifications. And they have the labs, you know, they'll have literally $1 million or more of lab equipment on site where they're continuously testing to make that happen. You know, when some guy's making some biodiesel in his garage, and there are people who've tried that and stuff, and if they want to put it in their own car, that's fine. Most of them no longer sell it commercially because they simply cannot consistently meet the specifications. But, you know, it can be a teaching tool, though. So Iowa State University, they have a biodiesel program that's run by the students there where they do collect the used cooking grease, and because they have access to the, you know, university facilities, they are able to convert that to biodiesel at a very high quality, and then it's used in some of the, I think, SciRide.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and we've been exploring biofuels through an interview with Monty Shaw, Executive Director of the Iowa Renewable Fuels Association. He was just telling us that a student club at ISU was making biodiesel for SciRide buses by recycling cooking oil from college dormitories. I had to call SciRide to confirm that, and they referred me to Rich Lehners, who agreed to a phone call to answer our questions. Hi, Rich, are you with us?
I am.
I'm so glad. Thank you. Now, what do you do at the DOT that you are involved with biodiesel?
Okay, so I work for SciRide, and I oversee the maintenance for the fleet and the facilities here at SciRide, so the maintenance on the buses.
So you know whether the engines are in good condition?
Correct, diesel engines.
Okay. They're in good condition from the use of the recycled fuel from the dorms?
Correct. Iowa State has a student-run organization that has a biodiesel lab. And they take the grease and oils from the dining centers and it turned them into biodiesel for us. And, like I said, it's a student-run organization, so the quantities aren't real large, but we take whatever fuel they can give us, and we put them right in our fuel tanks here at SciRide, and then, in turn, use those on the road here in Ames.
Is this a fairly regular, are they a reliable source?
Well, for the most part, yes. It's a student-run organization, so the quantity that's produced varies with student availability. So, some semesters they deliver a set quantity every week or two, and other semesters we may not see anything for a month or 2 months.
By the way, I talked to Mary Rankin, and she told me the name of this organization is ISU Biobus.
Mm-hmm.
So for people who might be aware of the organization. So what do you do when you don't get the locally produced biodiesel?
Well, we're always using biodiesel, except that we're bringing it in on by the truckload with our normal fuel delivery. So we always have a minimum 5% biodiesel being used here at SciRide, and at times we'll go up to 15% and even 20%. We do cap our use at 20% because that's all the engine manufacturers will allow us to use and still honor the warranty on the engine.
But it's really true that you can use the just regular bio, you know, the grease right into your engines as long as it's purified.
Correct, as long as it goes through the quality standards that Monty talked about to make sure that that it meets the preset standards for the buses.
Some of the buses say on the side that they are hybrids.
Correct. That would be our SciRide buses. And those came back in 2010 and 2011. They were part of the stimulus money at that time. And we purchased 12 of those. And those actually use a standard diesel engine. And The analogy I always like to use is they're like a Prius or a hybrid car, and except in the case of our buses, it's a standard diesel engine coupled with a high voltage capacitor supplying the electric energy to drive the bus.
And what kind of gas mileage improvement is there?
Our hybrids get about 7, up to about 12 to even 13% improved fuel economy, which may not seem like much, but when we're running these buses day in and day out, it actually turns out to be a substantial savings over the course of a year.
So, is there anything else that is might be of interest to our listeners about your about CyRite?
Well, a lot of the funding for what the federal government calls alternative fuels, they actually provide incentives for us to buy alternative fuel vehicles. And the next generation coming will be electric buses, and we've actually. Just 2 weeks ago, I had an electric bus in Ames doing a demo and having a look at it. So that's on the not-too-distant horizon.
Well, then we'll have to get to work on the coal-fired plant, right?
Well, perhaps. Or another way, it may even perhaps wind energy to power the bus.
Yeah, that would be great.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so very much. That was Rich Lenners, and thanks for being with us.
Sure.
Bye-bye. This is KHOI Community Radio, and we are leaving our segment on the complex issue of biofuels with Rich Lamers, telling us about the various ways CyRite fuels its buses now and in the future. For the last part of our program, we'll turn to entertainment, starting with the Pantorium session playing tonight at 7 p.m., preempting this usual rebroadcast of this program. So you can hear what it's going to sound like, we have a recording from the No Mountain Boys playing The Right Hand of Fellowship. That was the No Mountain Boys with the Right Hand of Fellowship. Come down to the station and hear more tonight at 7 p.m. And this weekend, the Webster City Community Theater will be performing Leading Ladies. We have the director, Therese Ahrens, here to tell us about it. That was the No Mountain Boys with the Right Hand of Fellowship. Come down to the station and hear more tonight at 7 p.m. And this weekend, the Webster City Community Theater will be performing Leading Ladies. We have the director, Therese Ahrens, here to tell us about it. Therese Ahrens, have you directed many plays up there?
This is the first one I've directed in Webster City. I was able to assist directing on All My Sons last year, but I have done a couple plays in Iowa River Players, Rowan, Iowa, which is closer to where we live.
And so you have to drive a little distance then every time.
Yeah, it's about 45 miles, yeah.
45 miles. So you really must love doing this.
Well, we very much love doing this. And my husband is pretty addicted to being an actor, so... He has begun the pull to Webster City for me.
Oh, and is he in this play?
Yes, he is. He is. He plays Leo, one of the leads that likes to become a woman.
Okay, why don't you tell us what the storyline is on this? I think farce is the right word.
Yes, farce is the right word, which means it's a crazy comedy. This is about two English Shakespearean actors who are down on their luck, and they're performing scenes from Shakespeare in the Moose Lodge circuit in a rural area of Pennsylvania. They find out there's an old lady in York, Pennsylvania, who's about to die and leave her fortune to some long-lost English nephews, so they want to become those and get the cash. But the trouble is then they get to York and find out, oops, they're nieces. So they decide to wear their costumes and try to pass themselves off as nieces. In the meantime, love ensues with the old lady's lovely niece, Meg, and then a local girl for the other man. And it's very funny. There are five doors on stage, and people are zooming in and out of them pretty lickety-split. So I laugh every night, and I've watched the show many times, so I recommend it.
And is it? Are there any special challenges about directing your husband?
Well, actually, I think we've gotten a lot closer because I'm, you know, talking to him about where his bra is supposed to be at. We have many things to talk about, it's fun because he looks quite a bit like his sister when he's dressed up as a redhead woman. So,
so you, a different side of his personality.
Oh, well, I think both of us. Yes, it's been very fun. It's been a great way to spend a tough winter.
Well, this is a new original way to get through this winter, then. I think you are to be congratulated. And
we're lucky.
Well, could you give us the details? What are the times, places, and so forth? And where do you get tickets, but no ticket prices, okay?
Okay. We're at the Webster City Community Theater at 1001 Wilson Avenue in Webster City. And you can get these online at wcctboxoffice@gmail.com, or you can call the box office 515-832-4456. The box office is open right now these days, and the hours are 5 to 7 p.m., on the weeknights, and 10 to noon on Saturday, and 1 hour before each show.
We
open up on Friday, the 29th of March, at 7 p.m. on Friday and Saturday, and also the following week. Oh, wait, and then on Sunday at 2 p.m. So we're open the 29th, 30th, and 31st of March, and April 5, 6, and 7.
Thank you, and it's been great talking with you, and I hope you have a wonderful run.
Thank you. We recommend everybody come if they want to have a good time.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you much.
You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I've been your host for today, Susan Franzen, and other voices you heard were Sarah Starman, Monty Shaw, Rich Lehners, and Therese Ahrens. You can listen to today's Local Talk Show and any of our past Local Talk Shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org. There you'll also find information about our guests, along with relevant links to today's stories, including ticket information. Local Talk was engineered by Aladdin Al-Kathari. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard was the Iowa Corn Song and The Right Hand of Fellowship by the No Mountain Bluegrass Boys, who will be performing live tonight, March 27th at 7 p.m. at the Pantorium. And I'm just going to tell you, no Local Talk at 7 p.m. tonight. Come to the Pantorium and hear the No Mountain Boys. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 515-292-2878. That's 515-292-2878, or contact us through our website, khoifm.org. That's also what you need to contact us if you decide to become a member or renew your membership today. Just look for the yellow donate button. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.
Funding for KHOI is provided in part by the Iowa State Center, presenting the San Francisco Symphony, March 29th, 7:30 p.m. More information can be found at center.iastate.edu.